welcome to the Lately in JavaScript podcast. I'm Manuel Lemos, the host of this podcast. This is the first episode. Just a brief introduction about myself. I have created many years ago a site named phpclasses.org that is basically a repository for components that are written in an object-oriented fashion. And that was meant to make the components more usable and useful for other developers. The site was created in 1999, and it has grown up to near 1 million registered users. Thousands of components were contributed, and just recently I started a similar site for JavaScript components based on the same principle. So, like in the PHP Classes site, I have a podcast there that talks about the latest happenings in the PHP world. And I decided to also start a podcast about JavaScript in the same format. And following the same format, I also have a co-host. In this case, is Michael Kimsel.
Hello.
Hello, Michael. How are you doing?
Excelente.
Well, this is the first episode. We have been participating also on lately in PHP podcast. But since people may not know you here, it would be nice for you to give a brief introduction about yourself, what you do, and your relation with the JavaScript world.
It would, wouldn't it? Let's give them a little ear candy. Hello, everybody. My name is Michael Kimsel. I do many things. Recently, past couple years, I've been the publisher at WebDev Publishing. We put out Groovy Mag, which is a monthly PDF technology journal for the Groovy language, and JS Mag, a monthly PDF technical journal for the JavaScript language, covering browser JavaScript, server-side JavaScript, and all those sorts of things. Maybe branching out into CSS and front-end engineering now and then. When I'm not busy putting those together, I do things like do some custom PHP and development. I do some training for the Zend company on PHP, and I'm trying my hand at conference organizing. IndieConf is a freelance web conference coming up in Raleigh, North Carolina, November 13th. So that's a little bit about who I am, what I do, and what's coming up. Thank you.
Well, that's interesting to know. Just to give an advance to our listeners, by more or less by the end of this podcast, it would be interesting to have a regular section on which you can talk about the latest articles that were published in your JS Mag magazine.
Sure.
Okay, but let's move on. Starting right in this episode, we also have a guest, in this case, Mario Valente. Hello, Mario, how are you doing?
Hi there. Hi, everyone.
Well, Mario is Portuguese, like myself. Despite I moved to Brazil many years ago, I'm still Portuguese. I know Mario from the Portuguese internet scene for many years ago. He was a co-founder of one of the independent ISPs in the early days of the commercial internet. But it would be probably more interesting if you, Mario, could give a brief overview of what you have been doing and hopefully put in context why I invited you to this podcast.
Okay. I graduated from computer science back in 92. I started the first Portuguese private ISP, internet service provider, back in 94. And I've been basically an entrepreneur not all my life, for all of my short life, sorry. In 2002, I got my MBA from the Portuguese Catholic University. And after a brief stint as the CIO for the Portuguese Ministry of Justice from 2005 till 2008, I left to finish my master thesis and to start up a new startup. And in this case, this new startup can be called the mother of all startups, since it's a micro venture capital company, and we are following the Y Combinator model to invest in technology startups here in Portugal. I guess that you have invited me to this podcast because I've been very, very vocal about JavaScript being the future since 2005 or 2006.
Right.
I think that's it.
Yeah, I think we may pick up in that last point. We have been very vocal. Anybody that follows Mario on Twitter can get an early dose of irony, sort of have some fun. Usually you make some comments about things that in the past would be claimed that could not be done in JavaScript. It would have to be Flash or something else. I'm not a detractor of Flash as you seem to be, but I would rather not use it because it was a sort of a patch that was implemented in the 90s to overcome some browser limitations, which nowadays are not present with the latest developments in JavaScript and HTML5. Would you like to expand a bit more on that, Mario?
Yeah, sure. I hated JavaScript until, I'd say, 2005, maybe. Probably for the same reasons that everyone hated JavaScript. It was browser-side. It was very slow, prone to security problems. I mean, the whole lots of reasons that other people also hated JavaScript. In about 2005, I started looking for professional reasons. I started looking into... I was a Perl PHP man myself from 94 up until 1999, and I switched to Python and worked with very heavy, and still do lots of work with Python. But in 2005, I had to look for professional reasons, as I was saying, into language choices and language trends, and taking into account lots of stuff that was going on, and especially the trend towards functional languages like Haskell or Erlang. I started thinking about the several language trends, and I came to the conclusion that JavaScript would be the language of the future for several reasons. It's the most deployed language on the planet. It's not only on browsers, but also on mobile phones in every browser, whether it's based in PCs or in personal computers or in mobile phones. There's lots of people programming in JavaScript, and at the time, JavaScript as a server-side language started to get some traction, namely with the Rhino implementation of JavaScript that runs on top of the Java Virtual Machine. There are also some other technologies going on, namely the SpiderMonkey version that was being developed by the Mozilla Foundation. And so I started looking into that. There were also some server-side engines, sort of proprietary or little known engines for JavaScript that worked server side. Yeah. And so I started looking into that and doing some research and some evangelism. And so I was one of the first, an early participant in the Server.js group under the Mozilla Foundation wing. That group eventually has turned into a working group on something that is called CommonJS. If you go to commonjs.org, you can find lots of stuff there. And so I have been convinced since 2005, 2006, that JavaScript is the way to go, not only in terms of client side, on browser side, but also in terms of server side. And I've been accompanying all that development and trying out things, and think that this this recent phenomenon of Node.js coming up and getting very good traction is indeed a very good thing. So
yeah,
that's it.
Well, you also been a detractor of Flash. Do you think Flash can be seen as something evil or just something wrong for the current context?
Yeah, it's not that that Flash is wrong. Actually, ActionScript, the language that you program Flash with, it's called ActionScript, which is a very closed. It's a derivative of JavaScript or ECMAScript, as we should call it.
Yeah.
So what I think was absurd and is absurd was that having three virtual machines running browser side. It's still a bit stupid. So you have a virtual machine for running Flash bytecode, you have a virtual machine for running JavaScript code, and in most cases you have a virtual machine to run Java bytecode. So that doesn't make very much sense. I mean, the Java virtual machine has been practically unused by now. There's lots of people who have Flash installed, 99%, I think, that have Flash installed, but that's a separate virtual machine. I don't think that makes too much sense. I mean, why program in ActionScript and have a separate virtual machine if you can do the same things in JavaScript and with modern technologies embedded in the browser?
Right.
So, I mean, that's my take on it. It's not that I hate Flash, but Flash is proprietary, doesn't allow you to look at the source code, has huge penalties in CPU performance since it starts inside its own virtual machine. And so I think that, like you said before, Flash made sense 10 years ago since web browsers didn't have the certain capabilities. Nowadays, Flash doesn't make sense anymore.
Can I throw out two points? One, maybe one in support of the JavaScript and one in support of a Flash approach. But one of the interesting things to me is as a developer, from the developer side of things, I can test my JavaScript. I can write JavaScript, load it in a browser like that, and it's fine. To try to do the equivalent in the ActionScript VM Flash world or in the Java VM world, I need to take this extra compilation step, which may be problematic, may not be, but it certainly adds on to the development time. JavaScript is that quick action dynamic language. I will say, on maybe in defense of the Flash approach, Flash Silverlight, I would say JavaFX, but not at this point. When there's a new iteration of things, I don't have to change my browser. I can get the latest Flash runtime. I can get the latest Silverlight runtime. I actually just hit a site today and it said, "Oh, you need to update your Silverlight. Do you want to do it?" I said no, but I can do that. Whereas right now we're still stuck in this notion of, "Oh, well, the next version of this browser is going to have a better JavaScript runtime."
Yes.
And it's going to have a much faster JavaScript runtime. And I do software development. I'm not a low-level C assembly bitwise hacker kind of guy, but I guess I'm just not quite sure why we don't have a replaceable JavaScript runtimes yet. Maybe not across all browsers, but it sort of surprises me that Chrome doesn't have that. But if Chrome and Safari and Firefox suddenly said, you can update your JavaScript just like you could update your Flash or update Silverlight, I think we would see even probably more innovation in that space.
Yeah. Well, you both have
totally,
good
totally
point.
Agree.
Yeah. Yeah. In the case Mario pointed, the problem of a resource consumption when you have too many virtual machines, probably one slowing the another, and also the portability issue of JavaScript. Is, I think, important, although nowadays we have many libraries that try to abstract the differences between the versions and sometimes between the browsers and the implementations of JavaScript. Other than that, one thing that annoys me about Flash is, for instance, it is not well integrated in the browser. For instance, if you have some text in a Java applet, if you can call it so, you cannot do a select all in the whole page and include the text in that is in the Flash because it's not well integrated. and yeah. other things like, for instance, I tend to use a lot the mouse wheel to scroll up and down, and then when you hit a flash movie, often it does not react as it was a single thing, not just a square in the middle of a page. And that is probably the annoyances of the flash, not just flash, also Java and whatever gets inserted in the page as a plugin.
I'm seeing similar behavior though with if there's JavaScript, if there's a JavaScript app on a page,
iframes.
Some of the maps is a good example. I can be on a page and scrolling down, but if my mouse suddenly if the bottom content of a map scrolls up into the area where my mouse is, suddenly my scrolling is now zooming in on the map. So I see similar. I mean, there's still some problems there. Just saying, yeah. HTML5 or Java client-side JavaScript it gets rid of those problems. It just changes them a little bit.
It's probably in an iframe that has a different offset on the page. Well, anyway, that was just I was just expressing a concern from the user, from the non-technical user point of view. But moving on on our podcast, another thing that I would like to discuss a bit, continuing what Mario already mentioned regarding JavaScript on the server side. You already mentioned Node.js. I have to confess that I have not been looking into JavaScript on the server side until very recently.
That was a shock.
Well, you program a site during 11 years all in PHP, and then you start a derivative for JavaScript. That's when you get more interested on the JavaScript world. Anyway, I have just tried in the latest days to actually do something in practice with the Node.js. And for those that are not very familiar with Node.js, it is basically a framework that works on top of a Google V8 JavaScript engine that provides many modules that implement common functionality that you need in server-side applications. So mm-hmm. we are already talking a different context. It's not just the browser. It's also the server side and what happens in that side. And basically, it provides many modules that are often available by typical server-side development languages. And I thought that I read somewhere that Node.js would be the PHP of JavaScript. But I just talked with the Michael a few minutes ago. He actually said jQuery was the PHP of JavaScript, but in a totally different,
different.
Meaning. Anyway, I thought it would be interesting to discuss the possibility that Node.js becomes a sort of PHP implementation of JavaScript. And in this sense, what I mean is that PHP already provides many built-in modules that provide functionality that is very useful. It makes writing server-side applications very quickly. And I think Node.js, despite it's very recent, it sort of took off last year, if I'm not mistaken. It already has many interesting modules, and it is getting close to the level of support of server-side programming like PHP. What do you think about this perspective, Mario?
Me?
Yes.
My turn?
Yes, okay. Your turn.
Okay. Well, Node.js being the PHP of JavaScript, that doesn't translate quite right. I mean, Node.js is a virtual machine for running JavaScript. And PHP is a language, and it has a single virtual machine, a single engine to run it. What I think was meant by that quote is that Node.js can make JavaScript as popular as PHP became in the middle 90s. And with that, I do agree. The biggest problem with people adopting JavaScript as an engine was that up until very recently, it didn't have a few functions, namely I/O functions, file access, sockets access, hardware access. It didn't have those capabilities because of security concerns, since it was thought that JavaScript would only run on the browser side, and there you would have some security issues. But once you're aware that you can use JavaScript not within the browser but within a specific virtual machine or a specific engine, you start to understand that you can run it server-side as well, and there you won't have the security problems that you have browser-side. And you can actually run JavaScript on server-side and add to it all the functionalities that are missing, namely input-output functions. And so that was what was basically happening since the early 2000s up until 2005. There were several custom versions of JavaScript, virtual machines of JavaScript engines, namely the SpiderMonkey engine from the Mozilla Foundation. And what happened was that then Google Chrome came out with its own JavaScript virtual machine named V8. And that was also adopted as a server-side JavaScript engine, and some people added to it some input-output functionality. And I mean, that's what the server.js or the common.js groups were doing. Only I think that they started on the wrong side of things. They started by defining standards and API calls and the definitions. And what's interesting with Node.js is that Ryan Dahl, when he came up with it about a year and a half ago, was that he said, well, screw all those standards and all those committee meetings, and I'm coming up with my own extensions to the V8 JavaScript engine. And so that's what I think is interesting. Node.js is a bytecode engine for JavaScript. There are several, whereas in PHP there's only one. Well, actually, I think that Zendwrite, they have their own bytecode engine, but I mean it's pretty monolithic. Whereas yeah. You have several bytecode engines for JavaScript, but Node.js has gained huge traction, and in that, by doing that, it might just be able to get JavaScript to the point where PHP is nowadays as one of the most popular server-side languages to program. And let me tell you, Manuel, one thing: if you go to phpjs.org. You have some guys who have ported all the functions from PHP into JavaScript. So you just include phpjs.js, I think, single file, and you have all the functionality, all the functions and methods of PHP available in JavaScript.
Yeah, actually, I noticed that site some time ago, although I did not go into detail. Of how exactly they do implement things like synchronous calls. Are you saying that they implement it with Node.js?
Yeah. You can just include PHPJS in your JavaScript code server side, and you have all the functionality of PHP available from the JavaScript side. I mean, you will still have to use some braces and some semicolons to terminate statements. It's still JavaScript, but you will have access to all the PHP functions that you're used to.
Is it something feature complete, or maybe it's still part of?
I think it's practically complete. Yeah, I think it's there's a huge list of functions that have been ported, and I mean I haven't looked hard at PHP lately or for the last few years, but. From what I see and from what I understand, there's a progress bar here on the site, and it's 83% of the PHP functions are ported already.
Yeah, that could be interesting to share with our listeners. I'm sure many of them are PHP developers. And I will also take a look, because I wonder how they implement, for instance, networking I/O. Synchronously as it happens in PHP, because I could not figure out to do it with Node.js.
Node.js is completely asynchronous. Its philosophy is asynchronous. There are several things that you can do to make it synchronous, but its basic philosophy is being asynchronous. What happens is that in PHP.js you have the I/O functions, which basically call the synchronous versions, the synchronous APIs of Node.js.
Right, that's what I was wondering, because I know there are synchronous versions for file I/O, but I did not find, at least in the latest version that I tried, which is 0.22. And for networking, let me give you more detail why I'm thinking about this. Because just as an exercise, I tried to port to one of my oldest and successful components that I wrote in PHP many years ago, which basically did some email address validation. It did not just validate the format of the email address and if check the MX records. It also simulated a SMTP connection to the destination server to see if it would accept the message almost to the point of sending the actual message body. And it was an L to implement it without synchronous calls. Because we have to do all with callbacks, and if you have to iterate over several MX servers to see if one accepts the message, in case one, for instance, rejects a connection, you have to skip to the other. It's even more complicated. Actually, I succeeded it, but. It took me practically 2 days to write a few hundred lines of code, which, of course, that's my fault. It's my limitation. It's for me. I think with everybody else, when you are so used to programming with the synchronous function calls, switching to a synchronous mode where you have to think a lot what are your strategies.
It's hell. You just have to get into it.
Yeah. Now imagine a SMTP protocol dialogue. You have to send the request and wait for the response. And depending on the response, you move on to one direction or another. And that done. Like a dozen of times in the same protocol connection, and I will upload that email validation component that I ported. Using JS, but it's not fully done. There are a few things that I do not handle already because I did not have the time to check how to handle timeouts of connection, receiving and sending data, but the most of the functionality is already there. I will upload it in the next days. By the time when this podcast is live in the site, it will be already there. So I'll add a link to that component. But basically, like you said, it was an L. But that's just because we are not used to it. So that's why I wondered why how PHPGS would handle those calls that in PHP there is only the synchronous version, and in JavaScript there are no synchronous version available.
Well, you could say that in JavaScript there's no I/O operations at all. You have to embed them into the engine, the virtual machine.
Right.
Now, when you embed those into your virtual machine, you can then use them either to do synchronous I/O or asynchronous I/O. What happened was that Node.js chose deliberately to use them in an asynchronous way, because that's the
recommended.
Yeah, that's the context of functional programming and of JavaScript. Now, that doesn't mean that you cannot call the synchronous versions of file I/O, and that is being discussed within the Node.js mailing list to have the two versions. So you can have file open synchronous, and you can have file open asynchronous.
Yes, for file I/O, that is already present. I just think that at least... For networking I/O, if it is already available, it is not there in the documentation.
Uh-huh.
But I suspect that for getting a better acceptance of Node.js, they will have to concede and provide synchronous implementations as well. Just so people do not get nuts when trying to do things like I did. Simulating a protocol.
I would disagree slightly. I think just briefly here. I think the one thing that will really 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 help adoption is to have some of the major Linux distros provide out of the box apt-get yum packages, and to have some of those adopted by some of the major hosting companies. If there was, if when I got a Linode virtual machine, if it just came with some moderately recent version of Node.js or some Rhino, something that had some built-in way, like predefined proxies and things like that, so I could just point a domain name at it. Maybe this is a control panel sort of thing. It took a while for the Rails stuff to get integrated into web hosting control panels, but it's there now. And hopefully we'll see some of that adoption by mainstream hosting providers. That is going to be... To me, that's going to be the thing that breaks into the mainstream. And it's one of the things that has kept PHP there for so long. Not that it doesn't have its other ups and downs, but or other pros, but it's just there because it's there. And it's right. So easy. It's built into it, but you can build it into Apache. There's a lot of utilities. I can point and click. And the hosting providers and control panel companies have had that nailed down for years. Is there enough demand for them to go out and say, okay, we're going to provide something for Helma, or we're going to provide something, a point and click for Node.js? It'd be awesome if they did.
I agree. I totally agree. And that is starting, has started to happen. I agree with you when you say that Ruby on Rails took a bit of time to come out. The Ruby language has existed for a few years, and it's the Rails framework that really pushed the adoption of Ruby as a popular language. In a presentation that I made a couple of years ago, I said that if Ruby on Rails became really popular, we could also come up with a framework called Drugs, and then we could have something like JavaScript on Drugs, and that would push for the adoption of JavaScript in a big way.
Yep.
Right. Well, I personally I see a great future for JavaScript and Node.js in particular, precisely because it is addressing the needs of many server-side developers, and as well provide interesting functionality that makes server-side applications more efficient in terms of resources, precisely because of that support of asynchronous I/O calls that make resource consumption more efficient. We'll see. Well, moving on to towards the end of this podcast, I'll just like to comment a bit about the latest content published in PHP classes. In JavaScript.
JS classes.
Too many years working with PHP. Starting with a review that I just published a few days ago on a book from PACT Publishing named Object Oriented JavaScript, which basically gives a good introduction of how to implement object oriented programming concepts that most people are used in other languages, but in the way JavaScript is done. JavaScript does not have support to classes. You have to instantiate objects. There are a few ways to do it, and the book covers that well. I think it is important to have books like this enforce the importance of doing object-oriented programming the right way, because it promotes reuse.
I totally disagree with that word.
Sorry?
Totally disagree with doing object-oriented the right way.
I meant in the sense of doing object-oriented programming in the way that promotes reuse of the code. Most people that are just arrived to the JavaScript world tend to clutter all the variables and functions in the global scope, and that compromises the possibilities of making reusable modules, because in the you may end up colliding names of functions and variables, and if you encapsulate them in objects in JavaScript or any equivalent in other languages, it just makes it better. That's what I meant in that sense.
Well,
can I? Go ahead.
Sorry. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to throw out a couple things. One, Rebecca Murphy, who does a little bit of work for JS Mag, she writes sometimes and helps out in other ways. Also runs the jQuery podcast for jQuery stuff. Some people know her name. She had an article in JS Mag from about a year and a half ago, but it's also on her blog. It's using objects to organize your code, and I've seen her give this presentation a couple of times too. She talks about the object literal pattern, and she gives some very good reasons and gives some very good examples in that. Not saying that this is necessarily a replacement for that book, but it's sort of a taste of why you should do this and what problems it solves.
Right. Well, that's what I meant, but Mario won't disagree.
you use the word the right way to do object oriented. There are actually two ways of doing object oriented. One is the class based way, which is probably what you're referring to as the right way to do it. But there's another way of doing object oriented programming, which is called prototype oriented way. Whereas in the class-based way of doing object-orientedness, you have classes as abstract types. In prototype-oriented object-oriented languages or model, you have objects and you don't need abstract classes. So you instantiate other objects, not from classes, but from previous objects. And of course, that once again, just like the functional nature of JavaScript, needs a different way of thinking. The prototype way of doing object-orientedness also means that you have to adapt to it. So I have programmed for a long time in class-based object-orientedness. I still have some difficulties going into the prototype way of doing things, but what I have been finding out for the last couple of years is that the prototype way of doing object-orientedness is much better. All these different libraries that try to throw up or do throw up a class-based while you're thinking on top of JavaScript. I think they're great, perfect for the people who are used to do that. But people who go into JavaScript and fall into that way of doing things will probably lose a lot, miss a lot of the nice things that JavaScript has by using the prototype-oriented way of doing object-oriented.
Right. Well, so I think we do not disagree after all. What I mean the right way, is, as I mentioned, is that people encapsulate the functionality inside the object functions rather than put them in the global scope. Yeah. Which something that actually Michael commented in a podcast that we did about the JS classes site, that people, for instance, they use jQuery, which is all object oriented, but in the end they clutter many global variables and functions to use it. And makes it very messy in the hard to maintain. That was my sense. What wouldn't be the right way?
I think in a broad sense we're all sort of saying the same thing, Mario. I think what you're getting at is take advantage of what the language allows, and the JavaScript is a lot more oriented towards giving you that the benefits of that prototype stuff. I do groovy work. And I came to it from PHP, very class oriented. There's a lot of parity. A lot of things that I would do in PHP, I can mimic almost entirely in Groovy. But Groovy, as Ruby, offers a lot of metaprogramming stuff that's very slick, very easy, and very integral to the language. So I can do Groovy, or I can do Groovy as I think about it, or I can do Groovy as it was intended to be, and really take advantage of the language. And whether people come into JavaScript, it may take them a while to get into the prototype way of doing something. It's really just a learning curve. And I think the more languages that we use as developers, the easier it is for us to adapt to the nuance and the features of each language. But it does take some time.
Right. Yeah, I think that's for people that come from other languages, it's just a matter of adapting to things that are a little different.
Now, functional programming, for example, does kind of take some people off guard. It takes a while. If Clojures just came to PHP 5.3 a year ago, it's taking people a while to figure out how can I use this? Yeah. What's the benefit? What's the drawbacks? What do I gain from this? Oh, I get this. Let me try this.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. In PHP 5.3, finally, there are the implemented closures anonymous functions that you can do the same as you do in JavaScript. Well,
but you see, all this stuff is closely related. Closures, prototype-based programming, asynchronous functions, this is all interconnected. You can only do asynchronous programming if you, namely asynchronous I/O or asynchronous programming in general, if you understand the concept of closures. And if you understand to use closures not in the right way, I don't want to say that, but you do need to change your mind from class-based object-oriented to prototype-based object-oriented. So I totally agree with Mike. It's something that takes time to adapt. I myself am still trying to adapt myself to this way of thinking, but you do get lots of benefits from these features.
Right. Yep. Well, this was mentioned just in the scope of this book review that I published. There are several other books that covered object-oriented JavaScript programming. This is just one. Basically, it is nicely written. It was not thought having in mind developers of other languages, but it's still a good recommendation. But moving on now, practically in the end of this podcast, I just would like to comment just a few classes that actually a few objects. I just got so used to the name classes that I tend to forget that there are not exactly the same concept of classes as you have in other languages. But let me just comment a few. Well, there are several interesting classes, actually objects, that were published here. I have published a few just to get the site started. One about making page animations to easily script them to provide very simple, basic but useful effects. I also have written a wrapper around HTML editors that several browsers support, adding special support for templates, which basically consist of marks that appear in the middle HTML, and you can visually insert them in the HTML editor. This is very useful for implementing documents that have placeholders to insert more complex HTML. And other than that, I'd like to mention just a few of submitted by other developers. One which is very interesting, which is an object that cuts HTML when the text exceeds a certain length of words. And this is very useful when you want to paste, want to present a text in a HTML page. That visually it will be better to cut it or make it shorter until the user wants to click on a button to expand, and at the same time keep the original HTML text in there in the page, so the search engines, Google or others, can fully index the pages. And you do not have to apply some server-side tricks to cut the HTML to make it shorter. But
there's one other that jumped out at me. Can I jump in here?
Sure.
I'm seeing here a JavaScript class from Sergei Selohov. I hope I'm saying the right name, over in the Ukraine. He's got a class here to allow you to access SQLite databases from Air applications. And given that we were talking about Adobe and Flash before, this was a tie-in to the Air world. But in general, I've been seeing more interest in doing JavaScript accessing of SQLite, because that's a thing that's built into a lot of the browsers now, client-side persistence. So it just that looks like it might be a good class for people to look at and figure out how to build their own, or to build on top of this class.
Right. It's curious that, after all, you can use JavaScript in Air applications.
Yep.
Well, it makes sense because that's what they propose, but I wonder if people would not prefer to use ActionScript since it's all an Adobe thing. But
they prefer whatever Adobe tells them to prefer. So
yeah, they obey.
Yes.
Okay. Other than that, there are several other objects here, but other than this one that is able to retrieve Twitter statuses from of a certain Twitter user using JavaScript, I wonder what other classes objects have you found interesting?
Well, the one I found most interesting is the one that I'm writing myself, which I plan to upload probably in the next week or so, does client-side resizing of images before you upload an image. So instead of uploading a 4-meg image that's gigantically huge, if you only need a thumbnail of it to be like 400 pixels across, this will do that.
Yeah.
So I'm working on how to package that up into something more reusable. That's my focus right now, but I should have that up probably in the next couple of weeks.
That's interesting. What is your approach? Do you use Canvas or something like that?
Hey, that'd be telling. You'll find out soon enough.
Oh, okay. That will be a surprise. As if we couldn't guess.
I have more error checking to put in, and I have to make it more reusable. But I'll let you know when that's ready.
Right. Well, there are a few other classes, but we don't have much more time to go through them. Other than that, Michael already mentioned an article that it would be worth looking at your magazine. What about the latest issues? What articles would be worth taking a look?
I'll throw out just a little bit of JS Mag stuff here. Don't want to hog the light here. But the current issue, September, we had a review of some of the smaller code contests. There was a kind of a smattering of how much JavaScript can you put in 1K or 5K or 10K. We had an article on performance testing with Boomerang, which is a performance testing tool for JavaScript. But we're almost at the end of the month, and I'm more focusing on what's coming up. We've got a new series starting from Jason Gilmore, a well-known name in the PHP community. He's starting a series on client-side mapping, integrating mapping functionality with JavaScript. And we have an ongoing series from a guy named Mike Schwartz on server-side JavaScript, pretty much what we were talking about today. It's probably going to be 5 or 6 installments, but he's going through server-side development with JavaScript, but he's using Helma instead of Node.js. We did have Ben Dowling gave an article in February on getting set up with Node.js, though I'm not sure how out of date. You know, it's been 7 or 8 months. It might be a little out of date now, but we've got this ongoing series right now about server-side development with Helma. So I'm looking forward to the next one of that, which will be out this coming Friday, October 1st. And to kind of throw this out to tie it in with JS Classes, if you use the coupon code JS Classes, JSCLASSES, at jsmag.com, you can register with that and use that coupon to grab any issue of your choice.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm going to check out Ben's article from February 2010 on Node.js. Just redeem that coupon, JS Classes, and it's yours.
Yeah, that's nice. I think that will be an opportunity that many listeners will take. And I think we are almost done with this podcast. I'd just like to thank Mario for coming. And I have just one last question to Mario. Mario, you are basically nowadays you work as a seed fund investor. Do you have any interest or preference for people that have projects for products that need funding based on JavaScript or related technologies?
Well, I have for a long time been writing on my blog about a future web development framework. I mean, if you go to my personal blog, which is at mvalent.eu, you can find, if you search for web development framework, you can find a few articles about that. And if you search for server-side JavaScript, you can also find some of my articles there. And it's one thing that I've been thinking about for a long time. It's about a server-side JavaScript web framework, something similar to Rails, like we were talking about a while ago. So if I could convince someone, some team, to build me up my dream web development framework out of JavaScript on top of Node.js or whatever JavaScript engine would be, I would definitely invest in one of those ideas.
That's great, but what would be the business model, or just funding because you like it?
Well, I mean, several other development frameworks exist, and they do make money. So it would just be there would just be some thinking about what the business model could be. But that was something that I would be interested in.
Right. Just to give some more detail for people that would be interested to consider your offer, do you have any restrictions in terms of projects that you would fund or not?
We will fund any idea that we find interesting from the business point of view, not from the technology point of view. I mean, of course, that we do prefer a couple or a few technologies that just for the reason that they might be able to lower costs, and from that I mean open source and free access technologies. We would tend not to choose projects based on technologies, for example, like .NET or ASP or Microsoft
right.
Languages or infrastructure, not because it's Microsoft and I don't like them. I can state that, but it would mostly be due to cost reasons. Because if the right project came up for investment we found out that it was a good possibility for investment. We couldn't care less about what technologies they are using. So from the investment point of view, we are technology agnostic. And then I have my personal preferences, but that's it.
Okay, so anybody could approach and propose a project for investment, or do you have things like geographic restrictions for the funded teams would have to maybe be in Europe or they could be elsewhere?
I mean, we are just starting up ourselves, so we don't have that many resources. So we do prefer that the projects are for now based in Portugal. But we're looking towards Europe as well. We are investing right now in a company in a startup from Lithuania, where we will have to do some traveling back and forth and some distributed team coordination. But we intend to do it. The rest of the world, I mean, it would be a little bit more difficult. For example, Brazil would be easier due to the language. I mean, right now we are focusing on our geographic area. Later on, if we grow up a little more, I mean, that, then we can start looking at wider possibilities. But I mean, once again, if a good idea comes up, I don't know, from Pakistan or from Australia, what we would try to do is to convince people to come spend 6 months or a year here in sunny Portugal. We are better than San Francisco. We have a better bridge, better wine, better food, better trams, and so we would try to convince the team that had that project, that industry project. We would try to convince them to come to Portugal for 6 months to a year. That's what we would try to do.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, so what would be the way to contact you? Is there a site that they can?
If you go to my personal blog, that's mvalent.eu. Or if you search more for me on Google, Mario Valente, you can find my personal blog. There's a contact form there. Or if you go to our company's investment site, seedcapital.pt, there's a project submission form there, and you can submit your projects there.
Okay, sounds good. Just let me thank you, Mario, for coming. It was great to have you here, have your insights. As well, Michael, if you don't have anything else to comment, that's the end.
Just, hey, Mario, it was great to meet you. Thank you very much for your time. And Manuel, thank you for putting this together again.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, and thank you, Manuel, as well.
Okay, bye-bye.
Adios.
Bye.